This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Ash Sohn.
How are you?
Man, finally. I was thinking this has got to be something almost maybe 8 years in the making.
Something like that, I think, from our initial sort of hookup, yeah.
Yeah, and you were just saying the idea of doing this in person, and it was really difficult. But there were times you were going to be in L.A. with Trevor Horn.
Yep, there's often I was sort of flitting in and out with Trevor. But we never managed it.
It never worked out. Yeah. And here you are, you're on tour, Tori Amos.
Yeah.
You just played last night.
Yep.
Where again?
We played in Sugarland.
Sugarland.
Houston. And Austin, tonight. And then that's a run of 3 gigs, and we've got a bit of a drive to Atlanta, 18-hour drive. And like I sort of was talking about in the lift there, you know, getting back, I haven't toured for 10 years, really, properly, you know, not like this. And then, getting in, checking into hotels, and the bus will sometimes pull in at 5 a.m., sometimes you pull in at 9, and then the long journeys and all that. It's kind of, it's old but new, if you know what I mean. And I'm, so far, so good. I'm enjoying it. You know, it's really great. The band, I mean, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
And John, the long-term bass player, awesome to play with. And to you know, the elephant in the room, to fill the shoes of Matt, you know, is quite an honour, you know.
Right, right. Was that something that he was asked, or you don't know anything about that?
I don't really know about that.
Okay.
I know that there's a few names were chucked in the hat, and amazingly, I was one of them, and I'm very thankful to be here. Yeah.
So how does that happen for you? I mean, you get the call from...
It was just an email.
An email?
Yeah.
From who?
It was an email from her manager.
Okay.
Would I like to go and talk with Tori? Am I interested? And interestingly, the following day, I got an email from Keith Carlock asking me the same thing. And I said, well, Keith, it's interesting you should say that. I've already had an email, but I don't know, but possibly he was approached first, and he's obviously completely and utterly tied up with Steely Dan, and he couldn't do it, and he thought of me, because she's based in the UK, and I think maybe he just thought, oh, okay, UK drummers, and, you know, amazingly, Keith thought of me, and he reached out to me. And by all accounts, he put a good word in for me too, which is amazing. So,
right. He recommended you. He wrote you just to say, "Hey, would you be available?"
Yeah, he just asked me literally the following day if I was up for it, and I said, oh, absolutely. And
How long? What was the calendar looking like when they offered it?
It was I mean, I've been working in my windmill, my studio.
Right, which we're going to get to. But,
yeah.
But like, in other words, the dates
as far
were,
as touring, I did The Voice for 7 years in the UK, and that landed perfectly for my kids. My kids were younger.
Right.
They're pretty young now, but they were really young then. And I sort of given a kind of the touring thing, I'd kind of not given it up, but it was like I was enjoying the fact that I was at home. And then my studio, of course, was the sort of cherry on the cake of why would you stick around. And I just hadn't really thought about it. I toured a little bit with the Scottish band that I play with called Delamitri, but they were just, I did two little British tours, one in 2014, one in 2018, and they were just couple of weeks, so it wasn't really touring at all. You know, In fact, I think we did more miles in the first show with this tour than we did on the entire tour in the UK, because it's so obviously so small compared to America. And I hadn't really thought about it. And then it landed, the email landed on my lap, and I said to my wife, I said, so is that it then? Do I not tour?
Well, that's mean, how long was it when they gave you the dates? How?
So at the time, it was a British tour, well, European tour, and a British tour. And I think they were talking that the time they didn't have the American dates, they obviously had them in their bag, but they hadn't shown them to me. So it was just a European tour, which immediately got moved because of COVID.
Right.
So we ended up just doing 6 dates in the UK to start with. So we would have done 3 weeks in Europe and then done the British dates. But so my first gig was the London Palladium, and it was a very big deal for Tori because she hasn't toured with the band, I think, since 2012, something like that, I think.
Really?
Yeah, something like that, I think.
Whoa.
So it was a long time.
Wow, yeah. 10 years.
So, yeah, at least.
And she's same with you, you're saying.
Well, this is it. But she had been out on her own, and she went out with a string quartet and did some dates. But for me, yeah, 10 years, like this. And I just, like I say, I said to my wife, I said, is that it? Is it done? Am I done? You know, do I just go and put videos up in the windmill and do sessions? Is that it?
Do you really feel this way?
Well, I was like, maybe that's it, you know.
Because what, nobody asked
me? No, people did ask me. And I would say no most of the time. Most of them were great bands, but things that I just thought, I always said to my wife, the music has to be great, you know, it has to work for me sort of musically first, and then financially obviously it has to work too. Let's face it, that's what we're all supposed to be doing here. And it just seemed right, really. So I was like, well, let's do it, you know. And I immediately gave up drinking, gave up caffeine, gave up red meat, started running again, and here we are. Wee.
Oh man, gave up drinking.
Yeah, well, I'm a little, maybe a little glass of Chablis on the bus.
Right.
But not load, not like I used to drink, you know.
Were there some offers over the years where it was close, you thought maybe you were considering?
Yeah, but to be honest with you, nothing. Most British bands, when they come to America, they don't do very much. You know, they do New York, they do Los Angeles, Chicago. You know, it's a handful of dates. So it was, even though there were some bands that I thought, oh, okay, this might be cool, the work was never substantial enough to sort of go, okay, well, this is a proper thing. And British and European tours, because of the nature of the size of it, they're always not very long. British tours, maximum 2 weeks, and you're done. You've done everywhere. And Ireland.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was and also the windmill was just doing so well, you know, and that thing was taking over my life, the recording bit, that I was like, okay, this is what I'm doing, you know. And then that email changed everything, and I'm now back to being on the road. One of the things as well that made me decide to do it is, you know, there's an aspect of why people know me. They know me because of that social media thing. And I just thought, well, maybe I should actually, you know, I've been doing social media for 10 years, but that's still a fraction of how long I've been playing the drums, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So 25 years ago, longer, was when I was touring here for the first time and going and doing exactly what I'm doing. And I just thought, but people don't know that. They just know this guy in this funny little round house, you know, messing around with beats that he shouldn't be. He's too old to be playing. you know, so I kind of thought, well, maybe it'd be a really good message for the industry and for the music business in general to see me actually doing it for real. No.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And how is it? I mean, how does it feel? Is it?
It's great. I mean, I one of my biggest sort of reservations was like, I'm 53 coming in this year, and I just thought, physically, will I be okay? You know, seriously, that's why I kind of sort of cleaned myself up and tidied myself up and started to run again. Because I thought, I don't know if I can... Can I do a two-hour show? I don't know. Yeah, how do you know? It's been so long.
Yeah, and you can't recreate that, right?
You can't just sort of... That's right, you can't...
You can put the headphones on, play along.
You can play for 3 hours, but it's not like doing a show.
No.
You know?
That you can't recreate that adrenaline. And
exactly. All of that stuff. And then you can't recreate having no sleep. And
yes.
And turning up, you know, tired. And then, you know, you've got to find the energy somewhere and... You can't recreate that. You've just got to do it. And you can prepare yourself, of course, and that's what I try to do. And it's so far, having said that, we're only like 4 gigs in tonight. It's been fine. And the British tour was fine.
How much longer of
US? We've got a long time. So we've really only just started. We finish on the 18th of June. Oof. In LA. So we go all the way up the East Coast, head over Vancouver, and then down the West Coast in weeks time, you know.
Oof.
It's proper
daunting.
Yeah, it's proper, but you know, it's going to be good. And I'm actually really enjoying being back in America, and because it's changed so much since I've been here doing this,
right,
as everywhere has. And I guess my early days, you know, it was a bit of a haze, you know, much younger, missed a load of stuff because, you know, partying as well, and you know, you'd wake up in the town and just stay in your hotel room. But now, you know, I'm that older person, I'm getting up and going out and seeing what's going on.
Right.
Which, you know, I did when I was younger, but not as much. I was 24 years old, saw in America.
Yeah,
it's a totally different experience when you're 52.
Yeah, no, I bet. No. As you were said, probably hitting it hard when you're on the road.
Definitely, but on the first time around, I was in a Scottish band, you know, with Irish crew and Scottish crew.
Oh, look out.
It's like, exactly, it was like a pirate ship.
Yeah.
That tour bus.
Debauchery. And just, yeah, that's the perfect word, is the pirates.
And I was the youngest, so I was the cabin boy, basically, on those tours. Yeah.
All right, let's get to the windmill.
Yeah.
How does that even come about? What's the situation?
Well, it was a magic sort of planets aligning sort of thing, really, because... I lived in London and worked in London loads for years, and I met my wife on tour with Lisa Stansfield. And
what does that mean? Was she part of it?
She was a production person on that tour.
Okay.
Yeah, and we, you know, she was working. She was tour managing Imogen Heap for a little while and stuff like that. And we were both sort of doing our thing and touring and doing.
You're
all
on the road.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and she was also going off on the road, and
so it starts as kind of just a fun thing, and who knows?
Yeah. And then we started getting a little bit more serious, and then it got to the point, well, let's get out of London. If we're going to have children, we both agreed, let's get out of London. And my wife's from Norfolk, which is the sort of east coast of England. That's where her family are from. And it sort of seemed a great idea to go up there. It's about 3 hours from London, so a bit of a schlep. I didn't tell anybody that I'd moved.
Right.
In the business, I just didn't say anything.
Yeah, we're big on that in this show, that white lie.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay to lie about that.
I didn't tell anybody because I thought, I wonder if that'll be it, you know.
Right, because they just won't call you. Oh, he's too far.
I just wonder.
Yeah.
And actually, people started to find out, and the opposite happened. People, more and more people started calling me, so I got more tours and all sorts of stuff, actually, when I was out of town.
Hmm.
Odd, this business for that.
But were you still travelling into London for sessions?
Yeah, I was going into sessions, into London for sessions.
So that makes it, what, 6 hour just travel?
Yeah, 6 hour, at least 6-7 hours sometimes. Certainly more time in the car than on the session.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
But you know, it's worth it, and we did that, and the house that we bought was an old, very old sort of cottages, two of them sort of stuck together. You know, like a couple hundred years old nearly. And there's some old barns attached. And we had a bit of land, and I had pigs and everything, chickens and the whole thing. And
John Bonham.
Basically, and the barns were the thing that when we looked at the place, we're like, well, if in the future, if we ever get to the opportunity that we might have some money spare that we can turn this into a rehearsal space, studio space, or whatever. It's perfect. And we looked into getting it done, and it came in about the same amount of money as the house, because it was a shoot, like a big space. And I was like, well, this, we've just bought the house, and we've got so much work to do on this old place that it was just, well, we can't do it. We just can't look at it. And just by chance, a friend of my mother-in-law was around, and he was talking to us about it all, and he said, what about the mill? And I'm like, the mill is about 400 yards away from the house. It's sort of out in a field on its own. And at the time, it was just the ruined bottom base of a wooden post mill, which had been about like 80 foot high, massive. And it was just the remains, like just these buttresses that were huge, like, you know, I don't know, about 12 feet high, 8-9 feet across, massive things that would have supported the wooden structure. Mm-hmm. And that's all we had. And at night you'd look across and it looked like a bit like Stonehenge, you know, across the field. And it was just this little ruin that we had, and it was cool.
Dilapidated and just...
Yeah, just absolutely gone, pretty much. I put the pigs in it for a while. There's a tree growing out the centre. And I put the pigs in there for a while because there's loads of nettles and things, and they ate all that. And during the war, the villagers would come up and take some of the bricks because they couldn't get raw materials. So they just came up and took bricks from the main part. So it was pretty much gone. And I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, it's just that. And he said, well, it's got a footing. And he said, those buttresses won't take too long to get them back in shape. And he said, you know, we could have put a roof on that was similar to what it would have had. And he said, and the walls, we could make it out of straw bale. I was like, okay, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, did a little bit of research about straw bales and their acoustic properties. In fact, I remember rehearsing with Trevor Horn and Steve Lipton, and Steve Lipton's a brilliant producer, mixer, awesome. And he said, Trevor, Ash is building a studio. And I was like, oh God, oh no.
Don't help me.
Please don't. And Trevor goes, all right. And he said, what are you building it out of? And I'm like, starting to go red, because I'm thinking, I'm a farmer, and I'm building it out. And I said, I'm building it out of straw. And he said, that's probably one of the best materials you can use. And I just thought, can I have that in writing? and he said, no, it's the greatest thing.
I mean, they're this
big, right? So they're big square bales, and they go up really quick, and it's really cheap, and it's really warm, really absorbent. We used lime render, which is a soft kind of render that goes on it. So that's soft too. It's not like concrete. So there's no reflection really. And it's round.
Yeah.
And miraculously, we used reclaimed floorboards, wooden floor. It's got a beautiful wooden roof with cedar roof on the outside, pine on the inside. And it just is a warm, beautiful sounding room by absolute accident. No engineering at all involved in making it be like that. It just is.
Did that take, though?
That took a year to build it.
Okay.
And it was one of our friends built it. So the guy that originally said, let's build it, he oversaw the project, but it was a friend of my wife, Ed, that built it. And Ed just did it all on his own. And I've got some brilliant pictures. And he looks... he'll never listen to this, so I can say it. He looks like that guy in The Simpsons with the crazy hair. What's he called?
Sideshow.
Yes, Sideshow Bob. Looks a bit like that. He's a Norfolk. He's a carpenter. He's a really interesting fella, and he's an old friend of my wife's. I went over one day, and he had this little Nissan car, and he'd bring enormous bits of wood that he'd literally drill them to the top of his car, and it's come across the field, this massive bit of wood, and just somehow get it up there. And he created this incredible roof structure. And I was looking at it going, and he's just all on his own. And I went back into the house. I said to my wife, I said, it's pretty clever, isn't he, Ed? She went, yeah, he's got a first in astrophysics. And I thought she was joking. Because if you look at him, he's like, he doesn't look like he's got a first-class degree in astrophysics.
Right.
And I laughed, and she wasn't. She said, no, seriously. And I was like, wow. And he just figured it out, just the maths of it all, and just no problem.
He's an engineer.
What's that?
He's an engineer.
He's just a fantastic engineer. And now he's actually... I haven't seen him recently, but my wife said she saw him, and she said, well, you know what you're up to, and he's at Cambridge. And have you heard of cloud whitening? Have you heard of that?
Go ahead.
Right, so he's basically, he's about to save the world. Because what they do, they clean clouds with seawater, and it makes them whiter, which in turn reflects the sun, which cools the planet down.
Whoa.
Right. So he's figured, but what they need...
The guy who did your windmill.
Is working now on this thing now. But what they need to get the maths right. Because if you cool the planet down too quickly, it's going to be disaster. And if you cool the planet down in the wrong places, I guess, it's going to be a disaster. So they need Eds to sort of figure out the maths. And like, well, how much... do we need to do? How many clouds do we need to clean? And Ed's your man. So he's doing an MA in something before he can do his cut to the chase and do a PhD or something like that. But he's
damn, Ed.
He's a very clever dude.
Shout out to Ed. So right away, it took a year, and then you start right away.
So right away is what it was really, was to put all my gear in. Just put all my shit in. Drums, accumulated drum paraphernalia.
Are you at the bottom or are you at the top?
So it's the base, the wooden bit's gone.
Okay.
All of that's gone, sadly. And we looked into actually getting a grant to do that, and it would have been like, we could have properly, fully, you know, restored it. But the drawback with that is that the grant that they offered would have meant that anybody can come up and have a look.
Oh, right.
So we'd have, like, visitors coming and going, oh, that's brilliant. And I'm like, I'm trying to work.
Right.
So we just did the bottom.
No, that's not going to work.
That ain't going to work now.
No.
So we just did the bottom. It was just for me to put all my gear in. Basically, my wife said, get all of your stuff out of the house or I'm going to leave you. It was that, really.
Yeah, the drummer's wife.
Yeah. There's just, you know, all of the stuff and the gold discs and all the crap that you know get
right
over the years, snare drums and I was just going to use it just to work on stuff when I was going away. Brilliant, I can work on the set with people, you know, for people, and just play in there. And one dude, producer, said, what's it sound like? I said, well, it sounds pretty cool. He goes, well, stick a mic up. So I put one microphone up, and he said, send me the file. So I sent it, and he goes, the room sounds cool, man. And I said, well, what do you think I should do? He said, well, you've got a couple of options. You could slowly progress and buy a few more mics and buy, you know, bear in mind, this is 10 years ago. And it was in good shape. You know, the sort of recording gear business was in, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you would have had to have invested serious money to get it to work. But now, of course, and in fact now, it's in the best shape ever. You can spend £1,000 and you're done. You can get making really good sounds.
Right.
But 10 years ago, it was an investment. And he said, you either slowly buy things and develop it, or you jump straight in and you buy a rig. So speakers, Pro Tools, mics. And I did that. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Absolutely no clue.
Yeah.
And I invested, I think about 15 grand, I spent on it. And then I bought some speakers. So under 20 grand for all the gear, mics included. And most of that stuff I still have. pretty much. The interfaces have changed. I now use Universal Audio. But I jumped in, and I didn't know Pro Tools at all. And you know what's really interesting, as you will know, I've seen all of these mics and all of this gear has been around me all of my life, but I don't know how it works. And I don't know where you're supposed to put it, or, you know, if you think about GAD or something like that, GAD will probably have incredible knowledge of microphones. I mean, if every session he's done, there's going to be microphones and some of the same ones. And it's interesting, you know, like generations of drummers, and that now all I get is questions on gear, whereas 10-15 years ago it was always questions about what are you doing playing wise, what's your sticking, what you're doing with the drums, you know,
what kind of snare is that,
exactly, right. And now honestly, man, it's like, what's that compressor, what are the overheads? And even on this tour, I put a little clip up of me playing, and there's loads of people going like, oh man, the mic setup's amazing. It's, you know, the people's awareness of it. And I guess because of the pandemic, because so many people jumped into remote recording.
Yeah, a lot of guys built their own studio.
Everybody just jumped in.
Yeah.
And I guess I was a little bit ahead of the game.
Way ahead.
Right.
But wait, you are an engineer.
Well, now, I guess I consider myself an engineer.
Like, you could do that. I mean, look, right?
For drums, for sure.
You could show up in a studio for Steve Gadd, and you could set up...
Relish that, yeah.
Right? You could.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is something that... You see, some people don't like it. It's interesting. I love the idea. I've always loved it. Like, oh, so you do that, it goes down this thing, and it goes into a little box, and you can turn a couple of knobs and make it sound different. Always loved that. And some guys aren't interested. They just want to play. You know?
Of course. No, I get that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's cool too. I totally get it. But I've always loved the both.
Yeah.
Like, if you do this to a drum, and then what does the engine, you know, it was a mystery. Like, you do that to your drums, you dampen them or whatever, and then you go into the control room, and it's like, wow, fucking hell, that sounds pretty cool. And then you can either leave it at that, or you can go, what did you do? And I was the one that would say, what did you do?
Right.
You know?
Right.
And also tie in with that, I'm very, very incredibly fortunate to work with Trevor Horn, and I still do, you know, and
just asking questions,
just seeing it, just watching
seeing
it happen.
It. Yeah.
And the guys that worked for Trevor at Psalm at the time, his studio, like, just seeing what they were doing, it was just brilliant. This was really before I got the studio, but then when I got the studio, I was just absolutely watch everything, you know, and I love it. And I'm experimenting, and again, some people don't like that I'm doing some unusual things with the drums, the sound-wise.
People don't like it?
Some people don't like it, yeah.
You're getting negative feedback?
Yeah, I get a little bit of negative feedback. Why would you do that? You know, you get a brand new, beautiful Gretsch Broadcaster, and you distort the bass drum. Like, why would you do that? And it's like, well, because you can.
Why isn't it pure?
Yeah. You know, there's, and I, and actually, to be fair to them, actually getting like a Hugh Padgham, you know, that producer, the guy that did Sting, for instance,
yeah.
To get that sort of absolutely $1 million clean, although actually clean's wrong because it's never clean, ever. Especially that when you start using valves and any analog gear that, there's distortion always in recording, the recording process. Always there's distortion there, and that's the stuff that people like, actually. But it's how much you use. But so Hugh, I believe, you know, is, I mean, his kit sound every time was like, you know, $1 million sort of kit sound, I think. And that's difficult to get that sort of... You know, to keep the cymbals up here and separate from the drums, and but still the drummer's just playing, and you've captured that sort of absolute ideal kit sound. That's the hardest thing, really. So I can understand people being a bit frustrated that, you know, because you've heard some of my stuff. I've been messing around with the sounds, you know.
Oh yeah. But you have a sound now.
Yeah, I wonder
even
if that
when is different, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Even when you are kind of playing around and it's like, okay, this one's a little different than this one. There's a sound.
Right. Like, well, I wonder if that might be the room too a little bit. Because that drum kit has not moved. It never moves.
But do you still do sessions in studios? Does that happen?
Yeah. In fact, when I get back, I'm starting another Cher album.
Oh, wow.
And I'll probably do most of it there. Yeah.
Wow.
I did,
And you just did a Marley thing, by the way. I saw that.
Well, that is the weirdest thing in the world. That
is like, what? Yeah.
I know. And that was 3.5 years ago, though, that. And that came about because the engineer that works with the producer saw a clip of me playing reggae on social media. And
back to social media.
Back to social media. And people want to destroy it and they hate it. And guys go through a love-hate relationship with it every day. But I can honestly say, you know, it's, for me personally, it's been one of the most interesting sort of journeys that I've been on in my whole drumming.
Oh, it's really worked for you.
I don't know, because people go, oh, who's your social media manager? It's like, I haven't got one. And they're like, well, you know, what was your plan? It's like, I didn't have one. I just wanted to be honest, and I just put stuff out, and people responded to it, and they still do.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. But that came, the Marley thing came out of an engineer seeing that sound. And then, I mean, the freakiest request, really, can you replace the original drums to some of these Bob Marley tunes? And initially I was like, oh, no, I can't. I'm not even going anywhere near that. Like, why? You know? And then they explained they needed, and they sent me I've got the sessions, the original sessions. So some of the drums were just two channels and they're marked bass drum and snare. And the snare isn't a snare, it's just an overhead. And there's a little bass drum that goes, what it sounds like. It's right. Not a big like people think.
Right.
It's the bass in reggae that does the bottom end. The kick doesn't. It's the front, the kick.
And it's
the
family man.
Exactly. And just one overhead. And then when they're it sounds.
And yet it worked. Let's be
and
honest.
It sounds absolutely.
Right? It worked.
Unbelievable. And that's again another reason why. Why would you fuck with that?
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah. they wanted to. You know, record companies.
It's like remastering, right?
It's exactly remaster it. What do they do? Remaster. You can now, I guess, you can do a remix it somehow, and the next one is put some strings on it, and then you can put out the same material again. And that's what it was all about, really. They want you to put strings on it. They want you to make it a little wider, and you can't with the drums being like that.
Right.
They had no control over the drums. So I gave them 12 channels. But what the journey for me was that I had to absolutely copy Carlton Barrett's parts.
So it had to be...
had to be pretty much the same. Sound the same, all the fills and everything.
How long does that take? Do you chart it?
I just learned it. I would do 8 bars, learn. And sometimes I would drop in. You know, with Pro Tools, you can let it run and it'll automatically drop in. So I'll play along for 8 bars and then it would drop in for 8 and drop out. And I would just do that.
So you just 8 bars at a time?
8 bars, sometimes longer. Carlton Barrett, this is it. I learned so much from him. And he was a really amazingly interesting drummer, because on some tracks, he's interacting with the vocal and the instruments. And it's changing every 4 bars. He's doing some little thing that's going with Bob or something like that. And then other tunes, he'll just completely stick to the same groove and not move ever. And it's like, well, these are great. You know, you can play 20 bars of exactly the same pocket. And so some of them are really quick to do. And then others were a proper... Oh my, and of course, I got it close, if I'm honest. I can't obviously play like him, but it was close enough for them, and I think I don't think it sounds better, if I'm honest with you, but it did the trick for what they wanted to do. And you know, and I had that moral sort of dilemma, shit, should I do this? Should I fucking do this? And then I just thought, well, if I don't do it, someone's going to fucking do it and fuck it up even more than me.
They're going to get someone.
They're going to, someone's got
they're
to do
gonna
it.
They're not going
to
drop and the then, project.
Exactly. And the bottom line is, we must always remember why we're doing this thing, which is this is our, it's our job. And it, and to me, in the end, it was a job, and it was a great job.
Right.
For me, it was a fantastic.
Is this the Marley Estate behind this?
The Marley Estate and the label, and Island.
Yeah, see, they pay well.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
And then having the ridiculous accolade of being on a Bob Marley record.
Right.
Bonkers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially because I love that music so much, you know.
Well, by the way, just to back up, when you do get the email from the Tori Amos camp,
yeah,
for a tour, do they give you a number and say this is what we're offering, or do they say
they ask me
what's your
yeah they ask me
what, here's the deal what yeah. do you want for it
yeah they ask
do, they do do that
yeah they ask me and
do you I mean let's just because we're just having fun here we're talking like do you are you in that position where you say you know what I'm gonna throw out some kind of ridiculous
yeah it wasn't ridiculous it's considerable compared to most tours that happen in the UK if I'm honest. And I mentioned what I was roughly getting with Delamitri on the last tour, and I'm part of the band with those guys, and the manager was like, yeah, I think we can do that. I think he was quite happy. So obviously right. Matt was on more than me. I don't know, but it was yeah. I was totally happy with that, and so were they.
No, it's a nice place to be when you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
was like, oh no, we can't really do that. It was none of that. It
right,
was,
right, right. No negotiating.
And then I also didn't regret, like, oh God, I should have doubled it then. It's because I'm not that person. It's like, I think realistically, this is a person of my age and my experience, I should be getting this much. And it was all good, you know.
So do you miss the windmill?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Because, you know, I just spend nearly all of my time there.
Right.
Just go over there, got into proper routines.
What time do you get there?
So I can just walk over there. I'll take my kids to school. And just after 9, I'll go in. And then whatever's on the hard drive that needs looking at, I'd start chipping away.
And there's always stuff.
There's always something going in. Like, I mean, what's difficult now?
You don't have a week where you go, nothing really happened, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's always somebody asking me to do something, and right. then I choose to say yes or not.
Because someone just on the internet too, right? Just
yeah, saying, this is
hey,
it. There's
would you play my song?
Absolutely. There's right. loads of right. that. In fact, that is endless.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. You've got to be, I'm
so
sure.
So that stuff, there's some things you just have to say no to because for various reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's that.
Not up to snuff and also just time.
Exactly.
Money.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'm sure, like, I know you've interviewed Aaron Sterling and some other guys that do it, the remote thing, and they'll be the same. They'll be bombarded by people. I mean, I've done projects in the Far East, and I've just thrown a ludicrous number at these people to sort of try and bat them off.
Right.
And they've gone, that's okay.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at, the ludicrous, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, here.
And they will, you know, and there's a weird, the rest of the world look at America and British music makers in a very different way. You know, we've got something special, Britain and America. And I don't know what it is.
Well, it's a feel that they can't do.
It's maybe.
What you're talking about.
Maybe it's that. I just know that, and I think there's also the credibility of Western artists.
Yeah.
Historically. You know, I don't know. It's interesting.
And well, you've got great credits.
We're on the right side of the fence. And I feel very, 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 very fortunate.
But it's also, again, it is the credits.
Yeah.
Like, there is that. You have, the work speaks for itself. It's there.
Yeah. And
I hit records. And
I think that's it. People, they just want that. Like, I've definitely done records for people, like, Italian artists. And they've specifically asked for me, I'm pretty sure, because of the bigger British and American pop records I've done.
I mean, Adele.
That alone, you can probably just stop there.
I was just going to say, is that the biggest record you've done?
I'd imagine so, really.
Just because of sales and all that.
Yeah,
just judging.
Just sales and the way that all happened was mad.
Right.
That session was really funny because the Fraser, the producer, this was when I was still living in London. He had a little studio in Fulham, and I just started working with him, and I'd done a couple of little projects with him before, and a lot of producers will just say, oh, you know, what are you doing? Can you come in Thursday night? And you go, yeah, yeah. And they won't tell you what it is.
Right.
For some reason, they all do that. And I don't care, it's work, so I'll go in. And you find out who it is when they press play, and you listen to, oh, it's okay, it's them. You know, if you recognise their voice.
Sure.
And, but on this occasion, I turned up, and he had a little kit in a booth. It's like sort of house kit that was always mic'd up. And I would bring my snare and cymbals. And I've just come through the door, expecting just to see the engineer and Fraser. And Adele's just sat on a bench, and she's like just looking at her phone. And I'm like, okay, sir. Because she wasn't, of course, as famous as she is now, but she...
But you knew who she was.
I knew. She was 19, was out, that record. 19 had been out. And she did very well with that. It was a big record, certainly in the UK. So I recognised her immediately. I was like, oh, okay.
She was famous there.
Yeah, she was definitely famous, yeah. I was like, oh, okay, it's cool, it's her. And she's very down-to-earth, Adele. So she said to me immediately, she goes... Fraser says, oh, this is Ash, she's going to play drums on the track. She goes, oh, hi. She goes, who'd you play for? And I'm thinking, ah, now this could be either good or bad. And I said, and at the time I was touring with a British pop singer called Will Young. And I said, I'll play for Will Young. And she said, oh, my God. She goes, I fucking love Will Young. I was like, oh, great. She goes, what's it like? I said, oh, I love, he's a brilliant singer. Really great to work for, blah blah blah. And he was on the very first of these shows, that talent music,
right,
singer shows, and it was,
right,
called Pop Idol. It's the first one before The Voice, before American Idol, all that shit came after this show.
Yeah, Europe was on it first.
It was invented in the UK. The Pop Idol was a British invention.
I remember being in Spain and it was a big thing, like way before.
So this was the first one 20 years ago,
yeah,
you know, actually is.
And that's where he came
from.
He won it.
And she, because she's actually quite young, Adele. It's disconcerting, but she's a youngster, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I can say that now.
Yeah, she's a kid.
Yeah. And then she was. Because if you think of Set Fire to the Rain, it was 11 years ago.
Right.
I did that session.
Right. Crazy.
Yeah. So she was at this, she went to this performing arts school called the Brit School, and the show was on, and she said, oh, you know, she goes, I love him. And she goes, you know, when I was at the Brit School, she said, this girl said to me that he's not gonna win it, you know. And she used to wind me up. I was like, right. I said, what did she do? She goes, I lamped her. So she punched her,
right? You lamped her.
And she got expelled from the school for 3 months because she was defending Will Young, and she goes, and he fucking won it. So
so Adele's a badass.
Oh, absolutely unbelievable. So that was the initial meeting, and then the session was really great, really productive. She was incredibly involved. There's a snare drum roll pattern in the second verse, and she came up with that, and she sort of sang me these little ideas, and I went in and they rolled it back to me, and I was just kind of, you know, doing these little buzz rolls and things, and I saw her through the glass. She goes, that's it. So that little, you know, she was really involved in the drum part, not just sitting there and observing it, you know.
And she was actually there.
Just
that alone
is unbelievable, because I'm sure that doesn't happen now. So she went. Oh, no, I did ask her. I said, oh, how's it all going? Because my friend Pina Palladino was working with her on that same record with Rick Rubin.
But not together. You don't work with him. It's all separate, or?
So I do work with Pina, but not on this record. This was separate.
I understand.
They were out in California,
mm-hmm,
and she'd done a lot of stuff, and she came back, and I said, how's it going? And she actually was pretty down. She was like, well, I'll tell you exactly what she said. She said, I had 7 fucking singles, but now I've only got 1, and that's this, which was the song that we were working on. So she was not feeling good about the record. This is what's so remarkable about what happened. So She then gets a cab and goes, and I joke, we have a beer, I'm joking with Fraser, I go, see you at the Grammys. Right. Ha 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 ha. Right. Drink, drink, drink. About 4 months later, he phones me up, he says, do you want to come to the Grammys? I'm like, you're joking. He went, she's up for six.
So is it that thing, I mean, where we've heard this, whether it's in music or even a film, and people talk about working on a project and how you never know. And those things are sometimes you go, oh, this is going to be huge. And then
yeah.
it fizzles. Was this...
The song was great, and she undoubtedly...
But you didn't think.
No. I mean, that's why I was being sarcastic. I'll see at the Grammys.
Cause that's what I mean. No, I'm just saying, yeah.
It's like... I didn't really think we'd fucking be at the Grammys. You know, it's sort of interesting looking back on it now that I actually did say that to him. And then he invited me out and he paid for my trip. And it was an incredible week that week. So I went to the Grammys at the weekend and I was playing the following weekend with Sinead O'Connor at the El Rey Theatre.
Oh,
and
okay.
I thought, I'll just stick around because Dave Elitch and people... and Dave, so I then get a phone call. So I'm bookended. I'm at the Grammys. Then the following weekend, I'm playing with Sinead O'Connor. And I thought, I'll just stick around. So I'm like, okay, I'll just hang about in LA and catch up with people. And, you know, I don't do it very often. And then I got a phone call from Trevor Horn saying, what are you doing, like Wednesday? Right. And I said, oh, Trevor, I'm in LA. He said, oh, we'll do it there. So he flew to Los Angeles and I did a session for Birdie and Seal up at Trevor's house in Bel Air. And Dave lent me a drum kit and drove me up the hill. And I'll never forget him saying, we were driving up the hill to Bel Air. And he goes, you know what, man? He goes, I've never been up this road. And I was like, really? He went, yeah, never been up here. I was like, why is that? And he goes, I just don't know anyone rich enough.
Trevor Horn, damn.
So Dave delivered my drums, you know, a fantastic kit. I think it was a Gretsch, I think he gave me.
Was it the yellow one?
No, it was a more natural.
Okay.
It was cool. And I did a couple of days with Trevor recording with Birdie and Seal. And that was a monstrous week. Grammys, Seal and Trevor's in Bel Air, and then I did a gig with Sinead and flew back. Bonkers, sort of crazy, you know.
Was that the beginning? That when you look back, do you feel like that was sort of where, okay, here we, this is it?
It was a pretty...
The rocket is starting to...
Yeah, it's a pretty miraculous week that, you know, in some respects, you know, when you look back at it. And what also... I'm a sort of firm believer in, like, you know, keeping yourself grounded. And I remember coming back, flying back, you know, after a pretty monstrous week, you know, that whole thing. And I had to take one of my pigs to the slaughterhouse on the Monday. And I remember driving my Land Rover.
For you? I mean, it was for
me and for friends of ours, and I had, at the time, I had 15 pigs, and it was in the diary. I had to take these two pigs to the abattoir. So I had this fucking crazy week. The weekend before, you know, I was at the Grammys, and then I was playing with Sinead, which was ridiculous. Daniel Lanois supporting us, opening up for us.
You know, like.
I got to sort of meet him and have a little bit of a chat, but it's him and a guitar player, and he was playing lap steel. It's the most beautiful.
He's
so good at it.
Is he kind of standoffish? I mean,
he seemed a pretty warm dude, I have to say. Brief, but it, you know, maybe it's because I was with Sinead. I don't know. You never know, do you?
Right.
But anyway, remarkable. And then literally 2 days later, I've got a Land Rover and I'm reversing it with two pigs in a trailer, which I'm having difficulty reversing into this space. And these guys come out that work at the abattoir. Their job is to kill animals. And one of the guys was Polish, and he had like a white hat on with blood across it.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like on my fourth go trying to get this fucking thing you know, reversing trailers, it's always fun. And I get it in, and then they sort of slow clap me, you know, because I've done it. Well done. And I get out, and I do all the paperwork. And I said to this guy, I said, because there was a truck with about, I don't know, 40 or 50 sheep that was in the next bay. And I just had a sort of a bit of a moment, really. I was just thinking, this guy has to do this job. He's not killing animals because he's a, well, I hope not, because he's sadistic. He's right. Doing it because it's his job. And I said, what time are you in? He goes, oh, I was in at 4:30 this morning, and he'll leave at 6. And all day, I had that moment of like, I am fucking absolutely ridiculously privileged. And it definitely changed me from that moment. I was like, I cannot take this shit for granted. And, you know, we shouldn't, you know, any little gig, anything that someone gives you some money for and you're doing something that you love, never, ever take it for granted, because you could be putting a bolt in a pig's head.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry to be so harsh if there's any vegetarians out there, but that is pretty much the reality.
This is life, man. This is what's happening.
And honestly, I had a moment of like, I am so privileged, and I consider myself that now. You know, like, just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I love drumming. I've loved drumming ever since I was a kid. Love music, and I've just been able to do it.
Yeah, but it's, you put the work in. And, well, talent.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I put the work in is I couldn't do anything else. I'm not like my friend Ed with a first class degree in astrophysics. I'm certainly not that.
Was there ever any other plan, or never?
I never had another plan. I started playing drums at 10, and I was absolutely convinced this is what I'm going to do.
So you were one of those guys, I think, ever since you...
That's it, I'm going to do that, I'm doing this. Yeah, I am doing it, yeah. No one can, and incredibly, my parents, God rest them, supported me in everything, and again, privilege in a way, you know, they bought me a drum kit, and they let me fucking play that drum kit all hours of the day in the house, and it must have been awful.
Yeah.
To start with, you know?
I remember asking my mom that a few years ago, like, how she could stand it, and she said, well, at least I knew where you were.
Well, I guess maybe that's it.
And you're a parent now.
True.
And, you know...
Actually, you know
there
what?
There is that plus.
There is, yeah, you're better off making a noise
here.
Well,
I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know where you are.
Absolutely, man. You know. Maybe it was that. So, yeah, I had no...
And by the way, not to cut you off, but you what is it called again? Like, grade...
That's right, grades. So
what's the final one?
Grade 8 is the final one. And I was lucky, my drum teacher in the UK, there's the Guildhall School examinations, and he was the guy that started the kit exams. So I was one of the first people to do grade 8. And I went through all those, and reading was not like it is here, but it was I touched on reading, so I had I knew what a crotch it was. And then little did I realise that later on with the voice, that's all I would be doing,
right.
You know. And I changed my sort of thoughts on reading music, because people would say, do you need to read to be a musician? It's like, well, of course not, you know.
Right.
You're a musician.
Which is still true.
That's right. You can get through life without looking at it. But then when I got the gig on The Voice, I was like, you know what, I'm actually going to change my advice now to some of these guys and say, you know what, if you can do it, because Trevor Horn was always saying to me, he goes, you should start, learn to read.
Yeah.
He said, because you know why? He said, you'll just be that little bit in front of the rest of the guys on the session. You'll know that this is definitely the ending. This is definitely the bridge.
Yeah.
That is definitely the kick pattern for that bridge. And he said, that can only be a good thing for you. And at the time I was like, well, and I did my own little, you know, hieroglyphic parts like we all do, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
But on the voice, it was definite. I'm reading. And what I did, actually, on about the third year, I said to the MD, I'm not going to prepare. And he looked at me like with absolute horror. And he said, why is that? Because what they would send MP3s, you have a Dropbox full of MP3s and PDFs of all of those charts for all of those MP3s.
How long do you have?
And you'd have, sometimes, if you're lucky, you'd have about 2 or 3 weeks to start looking at them.
Okay.
And I would, and I, you know, you'd find out the hotspots, if there's any tunes that might have odd time or big band things or whatever. And I would always sort of, yeah, prepare and know at least what's coming up. And I'd talk to some of my musician friends in London that are really good readers, and that's what they do. And I said, I talked to them about sight reading, and I said, you know, what? How do you do it? And they're like, we just, that's how you do it. You just have to be thrown. The best way to learn how to sight read is to be chucked in right in the deep end, and you just have to read.
Right. And you need all the pressure. It has to be real. You
it's again, like we were getting back to what we were saying about the touring thing and how do you prepare. It's exactly the same. You can sit in your room and you can recreate a session and you can recreate a little bit, like, the pressure of what that's like. But there's nothing quite better than actually being on the job and someone goes, here it comes. So, iPad. And I said to Dave, the MD, I said, I'm not going to prepare this time. And he said, why? I said, because I want to learn to sight read. And incredibly, he had confidence in me that I wouldn't let him down. And it was hard. I was making mistakes. Guys were playing through the tunes, and I'm the one making mistakes. But eventually, my sight reading got better. And then I wouldn't prepare then. And it'd be literally, I wouldn't know what song's coming up next. It'd be like, and oh my God. And sometimes it'd be easy. And sometimes I, oh no.
Why didn't I look at this?
I can't play that. You know, yeah.
Somehow
you get through it, you know, and you certainly get it good enough, you know, with the voice. There is initial preparation, rehearsals, and then you've got camera rehearsals, and then you've got rehearsals on the filming days. So by that point, you got it really.
Right.
You know.
Was there ever pressure or not? Let me rephrase that. Not pressure, but did you ever think about relocating to the States, or have guys tell you,
well,
you know, you should be here, man. You should be in LA or Nashville.
People would say to me, you should go to Nashville, you'd clean up. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure if I would, because there's some great drummers there. There's some really great drummers. And so Pino Palladino is someone I know quite well, and I've known him quite a lot of my life. And he was always talking about moving to...
Sorry about that, folks.
That's right. He's always talking about moving to LA, and he never did it until relatively recently. And he's done it now, and I think he's loving it. But I never really thought about it, because I was very lucky. I mean, I had work in London.
Yeah.
The 90s and the...
It just works. No, I get it. I was just curious.
Yeah. Well, I thought about it, but I'll be honest with you, I thought I was never good enough to do it, you know. Now I could, but now, of course, it's like it's absolutely ludicrous to think that I'd leave all that behind.
Well, that's what's interesting. Now you're at that level where you could be anywhere.
Yeah, I could probably...
You're that guy, like, you could be in Tangiers, and you'd be getting work.
Yeah.
It's like it wouldn't really matter.
Yeah, but I mean, that whole, thinking about that whole upheaval of the family and all that sort of stuff, I can see why it took Pino decades to do it.
Right.
You know, now his children have flown the nest, and in fact they're all brilliant musicians themselves, you know?
right. Yeah, I mean, so you're here, you're doing the road thing.
Yeah.
By the way, she's based in England.
She lives in Cornwall, which is the south coast.
Okay.
She has a house in New York, Florida.
Where is she from?
She is from, I think, South Carolina.
How did she end up there?
In England?
Yeah.
She married the front of house engineer.
Oh, okay.
And she's been with him, I think, for pretty much 30 years.
Oh, so he's from there?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, he's from England. He's not from Cornwall. I think they chose Cornwall because it's relatively remote, and they've got a beautiful house and studio and residential studio down there.
Right.
She said a lovely story about Peter Gabriel. Peter Gabriel said to her, he goes, "Have you got a studio yet?" And she went, "No." He said, "You should build one because eventually you'll fall out with your record company." And she said, funnily enough, they built the studio, and she did. You know, something happened with the label on one of her records, and it was like, and now of course you're independent, you're fully independent, you can do your own records. And,
right.
And that's what Peter meant.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, Peter's always been.
He knows.
He's way ahead.
He's always way ahead, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, he's a little too advanced, I guess. Have there been opportunities, maybe not, we talked about the touring, but recording.
Yeah.
Where, for whatever reason, scheduling, it couldn't happen. Yeah.
Oh.
Things you...
Well, there's one of the reasons, that on the I was on The Voice, and I was in Manchester, and when you get to the filming stages, you can't, you can't go.
Right.
You've got to be there. The schedule's really strict. There's hundreds of people involved, crew, contestants. And I got a call to work with Robert Plant, and I was just fucking livid.
Oh, yeah.
It was just like it was recording, and would have, in hindsight, potentially could have led to playing live with him, and I couldn't do it, and I was sat listening to not very good singers every day,
right,
just seething.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the worst thing that's ever happened. There's been a couple of movie things that I've missed out on because I've been, you know, you're always going to miss out on stuff. But I often feel if Robert Plant's come round once, he might come round again, you know.
Yeah.
I always try and be optimistic about everything. But that was one of the moments, maybe would have been one of the final straws for me. It might have been a contributing factor for me thinking I've just got to move on from this TV show, which worked beautifully at the time. Like I say, with my kids, I wasn't going away. The money was fantastic. It was regular. Everything unheard of for musicians.
Right.
Just at a perfect time. And the band, a brilliant band, those guys. Really awesome musicians. The guitar player works with me a lot, and he works with Sam Smith, and they all go off and do other projects. So they're a brilliant bunch of dudes. But I just wanted... There's just something. I was the eldest as well. I was the oldest in the band, by quite a bit, really. And I just thought, I don't want to be 60 years old turning up at a TV studio. I just don't want to do that, you know. And I wanted to, and here I am. So I was,
right.
And so that is another reason why I feel this is. If you could have said, well, what if you're going to leave The Voice, then you nutter, you know, why would you leave that?
Right.
That brilliant.
It's a good gig, right?
It's a great gig.
Yeah.
Some people go, those guys are still doing it. They've been doing it for now 10 years plus.
Yeah. Steady work.
Absolutely.
Was it shoot in London?
So it would be a bit of work in London and Manchester. TV studio is mainly in Manchester.
So how far is Manchester from?
So Manchester's 4 hours for me,
okay,
at least. Yeah.
So is it easier to just go stay somewhere?
Well, we would stay up there.
Yeah.
I'd go up there and stay, and they'd put us up. And yeah, all that was taken care of.
Yeah, you're not commuting every day. That's...
Yeah. And but if you said to me then, well, okay, if you're going to leave this brilliant gig that some people would give their right arm for, what would you like to do? And with all honesty, it would be something like this. Precisely the thing that I'm talking about. Like real music. A real artist.
Yeah.
You know? Absolute antithesis of something that I've just been doing for 7 years.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted, and I'm doing it. And I you know, cannot believe how fortunate I am to be here.
So, do you think that this could get the ball rolling as far as other offers for touring?
Well, it's interesting because I've had other offers already because of this. Because I've never really toured and no one's seen me touring.
Right.
People are not really...
So they're like, oh, he will do it.
He will do it, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a big Italian artist that I work for, did an album with him. And just bam, out of the blue, his manager called me and said, can I tour all year next year? And I'm like, I've got stuff with touring now. So, and that just came out of the blue. But they'd see, you know, all of these people follow you on social media.
Right, you know, right, right.
It's quite a lot of guys of my generation that still think social media is just a waste of time. And, you know, there are aspects of social media that are really not good. But there are also many aspects of it that are positive.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I also think that it goes both ways. I mean, there's always examples of guys who don't use it and things are going great for them.
Yes, that's right. There are guys that don't have to do anything. They're just magic. But I'm not that. I need to work for my fucking work.
Right. Well, but you have a thing, as like, it just goes back to that. You were just in early.
I got in early, but by absolute, or certainly on Instagram.
You have a knack for it.
Yeah, I don't know if I've got a knack for it. I don't care what people think about my plan. Because I'm happy with my plan.
Yeah.
And I don't care if people go, he looks awkward, whatever criticism might be thrown at me, I'm sort of all right, really. Because most of the time, it's the odd comment. But I do understand that that can be devastating for some people. But for me, I'm just like, you know what? In fact, I was talking to John, the bass player with Tori, the other day about this absolute specific thing. And I said, you know, I weigh it up like this. If some guy in his bedroom thinks that my technique is not very good, or my posture isn't very good, or my groove's not any good, or whatever, my hair's not any good, whatever they might take an offence at, the way I look at my post that I've just put out and that guy's commenting on, and I just quickly look, scan down the people that might have liked it, and often I'll see Stuart Copeland, Hans Zimmer, and I'm thinking, well, that pretty much is, they're the people that I love and I want to be like and care about what they think. So that far outweighs like a bunch of people that I don't know. I mean, even if, to be honest, even if a big name guy said something about me, I'd still probably be like, well, Copeland still likes me.
Yeah, Robert Plant's going to comment, exactly. Yeah.
Well, whatever. Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, for instance, the other day, he follows me and he doesn't like my stuff very often. So it's a moment, but Abe Laboriel liked a post that I did the other day, and I'm thinking, well, that is a genuine, bona fide, global phenomena on the drums, and there's something about what I've just done that he likes, because he has still got to move his thumb. And I just think, well, that far outweighs. So Abe, if you're listening, please like more of my posts, because but you know.
No, I get it, man. I get it, because like I was gonna say, you've been a long time supporter of I'd Hit That.
And it
means so much to me to see, like, it's the same idea when it's certain guys say, hey man, I like what you're doing. And it's just like, well, that outweighs everything.
Yeah.
You know? When guys,
well, now, well, if you think about when you started doing it, now there's everybody is doing a podcast.
As you said, everyone and his wife has a
No.
I know. I mean, there was one drum podcast. It wasn't even interviews, but yeah.
But I guess you were quite ahead of the game in some respects.
I was ahead of
the
game
the way that you did it.
I've said this. I just copied Marc Maron, but that was still when he was doing only comedians.
Right.
It was still just, and I thought, well, this would be cool for drummers. Yeah. And it was a hybrid of ripping off Mover with Drumhead.
Is that what the fuck?
It was sort of both, because that was my favorite magazine.
Right.
I was like, oh, this is way better. I'm sorry, I'm going to say it was way better than Modern Drummer, I thought.
Right.
And I thought, well, that format and that, boom. You know?
Yeah.
And then,
again, and then,
but now it's just, like you said, it's just par for the course.
It's, and so, you know, I get people saying, oh, you should do one, but it's just like, no, I mean, the time and the effort and the...
No, but you kind of already have a thing. Like, back to that, the social media. It's like, you have it.
I've got a little thing going on.
That is like your... Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what do you... You don't...
Yeah.
Yeah, don't do it, because you'll just take away from me. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. No. I get it. And, you know, because people go, oh, no, because you know, you might have... connections to different people. But
well,
it's like,
of course you do.
But then, but it's then also what you're saying. I should sort of like, you know.
Well, you could. It would kill.
I mean, everybody could do it, but it's just leaves a bit of a bad taste in my mouth, really. To do it, but it's an interesting thing, isn't it? And I think yours is certainly one of the most sort of respected ones. And,
oh, I appreciate that.
You look at the level of drummers that you get saying yes.
I appreciate that, man.
And I'm honoured to be part of that incredible roster of people.
I'm thrilled that we got to make this happen. And you know, so again, Ash played last night. The original plan, I just want to put out because we were emailing, leaving Houston.
Yeah,
like 1:30 in the morning. This was supposed to be the plan. Arriving at the hotel at 4:30 a.m.
Yeah,
I have to catch a flight. And I said, well, the only time would be like 9 a.m. And I was like, man, poor guy. Like, he would just be totally fucking exhausted. And he's a champ, man. You are a champ to say yes to this. Like, no, you must be. No way, man. I'm gonna be sleeping.
Well, no, it's been a while, hasn't it? So, and it's like, this is close as we're gonna get. So
I know.
It was a pleasure. And
I really appreciate you.
I hadn't had a bottle and a half of Chablis last night, so I'm relatively chirpy.
I hope you get some sleep in today,
yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. Although
right.
I'm feeling good. This is a gig of... this is the third in a row of three, which some people out there will go, and? But for me, that's right. Quite a big deal.
Yeah.
three shows. We do a two-hour sound check every day and a two-hour show. So it's a lot of playing and a lot of travelling and... but I actually feel good. I feel great about tonight, and then we've got a long drive to Atlanta, and we've got a day off.
I love it, man.
Yeah.
Listen, Ash, I'm gonna let you go. Thank you, man.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you doing this.
Thank you, Dave.
Finally.